And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest. The 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. We are at Thursday. It is Thursday, the 24th of April, 2025. You're very welcome along to the 9 to Noon Show here in Highland Radio. And hopefully you're with us for the next 3 hours in this show and throughout the day on your number one local radio station. We want to hear from you, of course. Lots to talk about, lots to flag. Lots of information to pass on. 086 60 25 000 if you want to join the conversation or indeed raise your own topics or issues. You can give us a call on 07491 25 000 or email comments at highlandradio.com. And don't forget to watch the show if you wish. If you're at home, work from home, work in the home, we're on your smart TV, your Fire Stick, on the YouTube app, we're across the Facebook pages, X, and on the Highland Radio website, highlandradio.com. Just click live, watch live, in fact. Okay. Let's look at the newspapers for this morning. The Derry People, Donegal News, their lead story, "We Just Stood, Cried and Prayed." They continue reaction to the devastating church fire in West Donegal. I'll read on here. "The community of Gweedore have rallied together to support their beloved parish priest following a devastating fire over the Easter weekend. In the early hours of Easter Monday, a fire completely destroyed St. Mary's Church in Derrybeg, a cherished landmark at the heart of the close-knit community. As fire crews rushed to the scene, locals gathered at the cordon on the main road, bracing themselves as the unforgiving blaze tore through the roof. When daylight finally broke, the slow smouldering remains were revealed, no more than the steel spine of the building left standing. The whole parish fell silent. And of course, the investigation is ongoing into the cause of that blaze. In case you're wondering, why has no one been mentioning that? It is an ongoing investigation. Gardaí not really giving any information out at this point, just to say that their investigations, along with other agencies, continues just to determine the cause of the fire, whether it was accidental or started deliberately. That inquiry is ongoing. That story is covered on the front of the Tyrconnell Tribune today, but they also make significant space for community uniting as 1,000 walk with Cassie. A large crowd took part in a highly successful 5K event and coffee morning on Saturday in Dunfanaghy to support local girl Cassie Sheridan. The crowd included of walkers, volunteers, fun runners and athletes. Cassie from Creasla has to travel to Holland for a bone marrow transplant this summer, and the event was hosted by St. Michael's GEA Club to support her and her family, who will have to spend several months in the Netherlands. It's a remarkable community response to help young Cassie, and fair play to St. Michael's as well, who were instrumental in organising that, and everyone who took part. And we hope that that treatment is painless and very, very successful. On to the Derry News now, and the ongoing social housing crisis in Derry has prompted a call for the urgent reform of housing executive protocol regarding properties reported as non-occupied. Speaking to the Derry News, Aintu Ballyarnet representative Emmett Doyle said such properties are reported by members of the public as being empty, yet they're under tenancy according to housing executive records. And the Aintu were digging around in the Republic as well as it relates to social housing, which is vacant. So it's obviously an all-Ireland strategy they're employing. Mr. Doyle said, "Sadly, there are properties in the city which have a tenant listed, but they have no one living in them on a full-time basis. Over the years, numerous properties have been reported to me as simply being used for parties at the weekend or as a backup accommodation in case a relationship breaks down." Now, it's interesting because that's a story we covered here in Donegal not so long ago. I say not so long ago, it could be a couple of years, of councillors expressing concern of council properties, you know, people with council houses, but they're not living in them. Maybe they're living with family, or maybe they are in a relationship and living with another person. And there was calls for a crackdown on that. I'm not sure if anything ever came of it. And in some cases, actually, the council house, the official tenant, was living somewhere else and renting the property out. As I say, that was of that time. I'm not sure if it's still an issue. On to the Irish Independent now, and people queuing in their thousands to pay their respects as Pope Francis lies in state in St. Peter's Basilica. They kept it open overnight, or much of overnight. Such were the amount of people wishing to pay their last respects. On that note, a prominent cardinal has urged the Catholic Church to return to conservative traditions as candidates begin to jockey for position before the election that will choose Pope Francis's successor. Timothy Dolan, an outspoken conservative American, said the next pontiff should embody more clarity in teaching and more refinement of the church tradition. I'm not sure if this feeds into the view of some that, you know, the Catholic Church needs to be more conservative. It needs to stop trying to be all things for all men and women. And if that means a smaller congregations or a smaller church, well, then so be it. That's a sacrifice they're prepared to pay. I'm not sure if that's the views of Timothy Dolan, but it sounds like it. Critics of Francis have accused him of sowing confusion and doubt on key issues such as attitudes to gay people and civil union, the principle of priestly celibacy and the role of women in the church. The conclave, the secretive election of the next pope that is held in the Sistine Chapel in the heart of the Vatican, will broadly come down to a battle between progressives who want to continue Francis's legacy and conservatives who are appalled by what he did during his 12-year pontificate. So I don't know if you are a Catholic, or indeed if you're not, if you would like to see a more conservative church, or would you like to see a pope come in to continue the work of Pope Francis. Let us know. 086 60 25,000. Well, plenty of money around RTE, it seems. The Irish Times and other papers report that state funding of more than 60 million euro for RTE's voluntary redundancy plan will depend on the broadcaster reaching annual targets to reduce its head count, it's been told by government. The government has approved 15 million euro this year to finance the voluntary redundancy programme, which was open to staff yesterday. So that means you say, look, I'm probably coming to the end of my career, or I'd like to pursue other opportunities, and you get a big payout potentially as a result. It is, I presumed, based on your salary and the amount of years service, but still 15 million allocated for this year alone just to pay people off. But RTE will require a further 47 million euro in funding from the government in the coming years to reduce its headcount by the agreed target of 400, the Irish Times has learned. Now, maybe that's money well spent. You might spend 62 million euro over the next 3 years, and it might save that. I don't know, over 5 or 10 years. Don't forget, they've already got a check for 750 million euro. I'm not sure if this is additional or not. Later, we're going to be talking about another protest down at Letterkenny University Hospital. We're going to be talking about a meeting that Rosina and TDs had with the general manager down there yesterday. We'll get an update on that meeting. And, you know, I just really, it's a hard old square to circle in my head how we can talk about, you know, 62 million over 3 years to pay people just for not coming into work. That's effectively what they're doing. And yet we're going to be talking later on about a hospital where 62 million euro would probably fix much of the problems we're probably going to be talking about today. And as I say, I find that hard just to reconcile in my head. I'm not sure how you feel out there. The Irish Daily, it just seems to be lots of money for some things and less money or will for others. What's your attitude to vaccines? There's been an awful lot of conversation about vaccines, and those conversations continue. Obviously, Robert Kennedy Jr. in the United States is determined to establish if there is a connection between vaccines and autism, for an example. We had the big conversation here during COVID, but obviously that extended to all vaccines, because people maybe see one vaccine as they don't trust, and maybe then all of a sudden they don't trust other vaccines, and then tried and tested vaccines are avoided, and it gets really quite complicated, but there can be quite a lot at stake. But what's the nation's views on vaccines? Well, according to the Irish Daily Mail, one in five Irish people said they would not take a traditional vaccine, a worldwide research project found, which means four in five would, I suppose. It depends on how you want to approach this story. A further one in four said they would not take an mRNA vaccine, with this sentiment higher among parents of dependent children. Now, why? I don't know what an mRNA vaccine is, really, if the truth be told. I know there was a lot of talk of mRNA vaccines around about the COVID time, but does that mean that all mRNA vaccines are bad? I don't know. But obviously enough people have enough knowledge or just caution that they don't like them. They don't like the sound of it. The Worldwide Independent Network of MR, an association of independent market research and polling firms, has released a survey of over 33,000 people across 38 countries, including Ireland. It found one third of people globally either reject or are unsure about traditional vaccines, despite decades of public health successes. These include the eradication of smallpox through vaccination, while a combination of the HPV vaccine and screening is hoped to eliminate cervical cancer. So there you go. That's a sense of Irish attitudes. Ireland's national cattle herd is poised to hit its lowest level in a decade. The latest data from the Department of Agriculture, Animal Identification and Movement records revealed. This is the Irish Farmers Journal. There were almost 290,000 fewer cattle on Irish farms on the 1st of March 25 compared to March 24, the third year in a row that total cattle numbers in the country have fallen. Why? Both dairy cow and suckler cow numbers have reduced, and the most recent AIM data is an early indication that the reduction in the national herd is accelerating. The 2025 versus 2024 drop in total cattle numbers was 2.5 times greater than 24 versus 23 drop. Quota abolition in 2015, or following it, dairy cow numbers surged while suckler cow numbers fell steadily. Now, though, the data shows that dairy cow numbers have joined the suckler decline. And is this that people see the sort of a less favourable trading environment and they're getting out of milk? Is that what's happening, or are they being incentivised to do so? People would tell me anecdotally the beef prices at the moment are fantastic. They're getting great money for beef, although I think we're going to speak to someone later on who might contest that. I don't know. So you'd imagine that would mean that there's more cattle or more interest if people are getting good money. And I know there's two different sort of areas of farming we're talking about there, but maybe you're in the industry and you want to give us an insight into what's going on. I'll go to the Irish Daily Mirror. Pressure is mounting on Volodymyr Zelensky. And I wonder maybe any of our Ukrainian listeners, if they are listening, maybe want to have a say on this. Effectively, Donald Trump is saying Russia has got Crimea. You know, he didn't fight for it in 2014. They've got an awful lot of military there. It's theirs. They're not going to give it back. You're going to have to, Ukraine, accept that this is Russian territory. This is as part of any deal. And it would seem that Donald Trump, the American administration's patience is running out, that they are going to pull out. So that means, you know, not assisting in negotiations to find a settlement, not sharing intelligence, probably no financial backing, and probably no delivery of weaponry. And don't forget, it was Donald Trump that first gave Ukrainians the, the Javelin missiles, which were critical in holding the Russians back. What Donald Trump effectively is saying is that you're going to have to accept what Russia want here. You're going to have to give up some of your land because they're going to take it all anyway in 4 or 5 years. There's 5,000 Russian and Ukrainian soldiers dying every single week. This is the deal. Take it or leave it. We're walking away if you don't. What's your views on that? Do you believe that the likes of Europe should step up and say, you know what, this is very important about Ukraine, but it's about the bigger picture as well? Or if you are you of the view that Ukraine have a victory and that they held Russia back, Russia didn't take the entire country in 3 days, and now is the time for them to cede some land to the Russians. So what's your views on all of it? Of course, particularly interested in those from Ukraine, but not exclusively. Well, Donald Trump has slammed Volodymyr Zelensky for saying he will not accept the Russian occupation of Crimea. Don't know why I'm struggling to say that today. The US president's rant fueled further speculation about his pivot towards the Kremlin. He said Ukraine's president, Mr. Zelensky, was boasting about refusing to recognize the occupation of Crimea, which was seized in 2014. Mr. Trump added, "It's very inflammatory statements like Zelensky's that make it so difficult to settle this war. He has nothing to boast about." Is there any way, if they keep going, because we have to consider if it were our children, whether they're Russian or they're Ukrainian, is there any way really that Ukraine can hold Russia back or push Russia back into the long term? You know, there's a huge sacrifice, but obviously Russia are, you know, the bully boys, you could argue as well, that they're looking to take parts of Ukraine. Look, they'd love to take all of it. And if they succeed there, where to the end? Do they keep going? What's your views, your nuanced views, taking everything into consideration, 086 60 25,000? The government's missed its social housing targets, down by 18% from where the target should be. The government once again missed its social housing targets last year. The target now to build social homes in 2024 was missed by 18%, with overall delivery of social homes down 11% on 2023. So in fact, last year, it's not only targets missed, it's actually down on 23. It comes months after it was confirmed that it had missed its overall housing target of 33,300 after promising delivery of 40,000 new homes in 24 during the general election. And potentially good news, and it makes a little bit of sense, I suppose. This is in The Sun. Adults can beat fatal peanut allergies by building up a tolerance to tiny amounts of them. The desensitization trial saw 21 subjects given peanut flour to eat each day under supervision. They started with the equivalent of up to 1% of a nut. Dosage was slowly increased until they could tolerate up to 100 milligrams of peanut proteins. Then they switched to the real thing. By the end, two-thirds could eat five peanuts without reaction. Now, of course, it's not about being able to eat peanuts again. It's about building up a resilience to peanuts being in a meal that you might not realize. So two-thirds at the end of the process, two-thirds could eat five peanuts a day without reaction. So that means any trace you would imagine of peanuts in food would have caused little harm. Similar studies previously have focused on children, but the latest research offers hope to thousands of adults who have the allergy. Okay, that was a run through some of the newspapers. 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text number. We'll be back with our first guest after a quick break. E. O'Donnell is CEO of the Irish Fish Producers Organisation. He's with me now. Good morning to you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you.
Right. Now, you are calling, the organisation is calling for an urgent reform of Ireland's sea fisheries legislation. And this follows on from a court case, a court ruling. So run us through that, E.
Well, quite simply, Greg, we have a situation under the legislation at the moment that even minor infringements in sea fisheries legislation is run through the circuit court system. Full jury trials, criminal proceedings. This case goes back to 2021, and essentially the case was thrown out by the judge on the basis that he directed the jury to return a verdict of not guilty. Basically, the evidence presented was inadmissible.
What part of that was inadmissible? Was it, you know, is that a technicality then, really? I mean, you're calling for a change of regulations. Was he acquitted on a technicality or found not guilty of the... Of course he was found not guilty, don't get me wrong, but was this a failure in the prosecution, arguably?
Well, it was basically a success in the defence in so much as that the DPP was found to have relied on inadmissible evidence and hearsay evidence in a situation where it was a minor infringement in relation to the recording in the logbook on board the vessel of the estimate of the quantity on board prior to landing.
Right. So there is also a sense that fishermen in this part of the world are particularly focused upon. Is that still a sense that is the case, or is this countrywide?
Well, there's certainly a sense that we need to have a good, robust system, a system of control that's harmonised throughout Europe. We feel very strongly that that's not the case. We need to have a system whereby there's provision for, if there's infringements, there's administrative processes, not circuit criminal court proceedings. So there's a need across for Ireland to be in line with the rest of Europe in terms of its proceedings and in terms of the enforcement of the control laws. And please understand that from the seafood sector, we are fully committed to control that's appropriate and fit for purpose.
Yes, it does seem quite... I mean, this, of course, is bound to have had a severe impact on Gareth Murphy as well, because this has been hanging over his head for quite some time. And, you know, it'll be bittersweet, obviously, to be found... for the charges against him to be found unproven, but at the same time, he still spent a number of years with this hanging over his head.
Absolutely, and we must remember this is a circuit court proceeding. This is a criminal proceeding. This is a very expensive process. It's a very long, drawn-out process. It involves a full jury trial. It went on for more than 2 days. And in concluding, basically the judge directed the jury to return a verdict of not guilty.
How do we go about, if there is a will, to reform sea fisheries legislation? Because any ministers responsible for this area I've spoken to sort of says, well, listen, we can't interfere here. You know, there has to be that sort of separation. Do you accept that argument? And if so, how do we achieve reform?
Well, the important thing to remember here is that the court found in this instance that there was no case to answer. The DPP failed to present fundamental evidence. It's basically a situation where we need to go back to the basics. We need to look at the Maritime Jurisdiction Act of 2006. It needs to be looked at, it needs to be reformed, it needs to be brought into line with current trends in control regulations throughout Europe. This is what we need if we want to have a competitive, sustainable, long-term seafood business.
But presumably this needs to happen sooner rather than later, because one could argue this effectively was a test case, and I don't know if there's been previous convictions or any cases that are pending, but one must imagine that it could have some ramifications there.
It's a very important case. It was viewed certainly within the industry as being a test case. We have to be aware of the fact that there's a number of cases pending going through the system. They're based in very similar situations in relation to minor infringements on the estimation of what you have on board. And we have to remember what the problem is here, that the skipper or the master of the vessel is expected to know by species within a certain very narrow tolerance how much fish he has on board before they're discharged and before they're actually weighed.
So I was going to say that just for those who aren't in the industry and might not get it, this is a guess. There is no, is there means of weighing your catch on the boat? You guess what you have effectively. It's an informed guess. And then it's weighed on the pier or wherever. And if there's more than a 10% discrepancy, you could find yourself in a criminal trial.
Exactly. We have a situation where you have to guess at sea. You've got to record this in the logbook. If that's outside the 10% tolerance that's provided after the weighing, then you're subject to criminal proceedings. It's a ridiculous situation.
Right. So maybe I didn't pick up the answer. How is reform of Ireland sea fisheries legislation achieved? Who makes that decision that says, right, we need to look at this, we need to align ourselves as the IFPO are calling for with European norms? Like, how is change driven here? Who has to say, okay, we need to look at this?
This has to be initiated at government level. But in the short term, what we have to do is we're basically asking the DPP to take account of this ruling, take account of the real life situation that's pertaining, and to look at the pipeline of cases and to push very fast for urgent reform in relation to the legislation pertaining to this matter.
Yeah, because until such time as that happens, this 10% remains. It can't be disregarded. Those out fishing and coming back to port, they are still under this legislation.
They're still under this legislation. And remember, this 10% tolerance at the moment applies to all the species that you have on board. If you've got a mixed catch, the challenge we have in the real life situation is to estimate species by species within 10% tolerance what exactly weight you've got on board. This cannot be done in the real life situation until you've discharged the fish and have them weighed under camera in the factories with live links to the SFPA.
Is there a tolerance that would be acceptable to the IFPO, for an example, or a completely different system?
Well, within Europe, at Fisheries Council level, at the last Fisheries Council meeting, there was a call across Europe by a number of states to have a reform of this margin of tolerance. This margin of tolerance is currently part of the control regulations, but in practice, it's found to be unworkable. It's a guesstimate.
Is 15, is 20% acceptable?
In a very small, in a large landing of fish, 15 or 20% margin of tolerance may be insufficient, particularly when you're dealing with mixed catches. Mm. What we're proposing here, we have a robust system of control. Let's move the actual process of weighing of the fish and determining the weight by species in the factories under camera.
And I know you have to go, but one very quick question. What is happening here then? Are are we underfishing? If you know what I mean, if you're trying to avoid rolling the dice on this, and you are guessing, are boats coming ashore with less fish than they potentially could catch to avoid? You know, what impact is this having on the day to day, other than the anxiety of getting it wrong?
The ridiculous situation is that you can be prosecuted for under-declaring your catch in excess of the 10% provision as well. So you have a situation where you can be taken to court for estimating greater than 10% or less than 10%.
Okay. I get you. Right. It's a narrow window. Thanks for your time. That's E. O'Donnell, CEO of the Irish Fish Producers Organisation. A couple of people messaging in. Ulster final should be played in Clonus. Hopefully it's County Down and Tyrone writing off the other teams. Another, without being presumptuous, reports of Ulster final taking place in Croke Park is unacceptable. Clonus is the home of Ulster football for finals. You wouldn't hear Munster final being held in Croke Park. Saturday evening in Croke Park is ridiculous due to cost, distance, traffic and hotels, trying to rob people for one night stay. However, good luck to Donegal this weekend. It's one of those, isn't it? You don't want to look too far ahead, but at the same time, you have to keep one eye on it. We're going to dig into that a little bit deeper, by the way, to those suggestions. There's a possibility that final could be held in Croke Park. Just curious, Greg, how long can foreign nationals drive around with no paperwork on the windscreens and foreign number plates? If I bought a car from Northern Ireland, I'd only have 1 month to clear it. Wondering, is there two different laws here? I believe that they can do so for as long as the provision for people to be housed here. I'll get the correct terminology. It can be insured in their own country, and also in relation to tax, I believe it's governed by whatever the country or origin of the vehicle is. I had all that information in my head. It's hard to retain everything, but I believe it's whilst the current arrangements are in place, if that makes sense. Normally, you're only allowed to drive a foreign registered vehicle in this country for a certain amount of time, but that has been waived. Presumably, it is the way it is because the law is set up that, sure, when peace breaks out in Ukraine, everyone will get into the cars and drive back again, right? I presume that's the notion. Now we're 3 years into it now. I'm not sure if it's being reviewed, but let me find out. I believe it's indefinitely under the current situation. Teachers under pressure, factors such as communication with non-English speaking pupils and parents, short day, short year, approximately 100 days primary, adding permanent staff further increases access to a number of leave options, therefore the need for substitutes to cover these leave days. The education budget for such an absence is enormous. Spreading this budget to support pupils would help. As for removing religion from our schools, don't agree. Children need some guidance in faith and hope. If some of our teachers are turning away, then so be it. But let others carry on the good work they are doing. That's off the back of a conversation we had yesterday. Is teaching not about education? Education of facts? There are no facts in religion at all. It's all hearsay and blind belief. There's no proof. The Bible was altered to suit our way of life by King James. In 1611. That's a fact. There is actually more proof of UFOs, but if you say that, you'll be chucked into the loony bin. That is the elephant in the room, and you'll be bombarded about the message, but they have all been brainwashed. Sorry for the backlash you will receive. That's fine. It's fine. It's your view. But you see, faith is something completely different. It's these people's faith, and it's something they believe and trust and will await proof in the next life or whatever it might be. So you're of course approaching this from fact base. From your perspective, but faith and facts don't necessarily cancel each other out. A caller says, in relation to the traffic in Letterkenny yesterday, we had Christian yesterday talking about Tuesdays and how bad the traffic was. He was saying, look, the council have no plan to deal with traffic lights going out. The Gardaí don't have a plan. Someone needs to have a plan. But a caller says, it's the same every Tuesday after Easter. People all going home, same time. All goes into a bottleneck and jams up. Council also had traffic lights on the Remelton Road at Woodlands. Just build the bridge. Problem solved. It kind of does all come back to that, doesn't it? 37 councillors in the council and not one has done anything to advance the building of a bridge except talks. not defending councillors. They can raise their issues and pass their motions, but this is down to government. It's down to Transport Infrastructure Ireland. It's down to the Department of Transport. With all respect to the councillors, you know, they don't have much of a say. They can kind of have a... They can campaign and they can maybe have a bit of a say in how maintenance funding is allocated for roads annually, and maybe have an input into which roads are gritted. But when you're talking about major road infrastructure, I'm afraid that's well above their pay scale. Caller says, Letterkenny has 25,000 people. In other countries, that's deemed a village. Our traffic issue is quite laughable and only shows a complete lack of forward thinking. Where, what are the politicians doing? The traffic yesterday is just an increase. This is on Tuesday. The traffic on Tuesday is just an increase in our population and therefore an increase in traffic. We've a poor public traffic network and this is the result. It's all down to the council's failure to plan ahead. But I do think they're planning ahead with the bridge in mind. Morning, Greg. Do you know if they are actually going ahead with plans to reduce the two lanes to one lane outside the Mount Errigal Hotel? Because if they do, this town is banjaxed, which is a fantastic word. I had to travel 4.4 kilometres yesterday to collect my dog from the vets, basically from Arena 7 to the vets across from the new Lidl. The total driving time there and back, 1 hour, 10 minutes. Wow, that's ridiculous. Somebody needs to do something. Where are the TDs? As far as I'm aware, and as part of active travel plans, they are still going ahead with plans to reduce the three lanes outside of the Mount Errigal to two lanes. I don't believe it's down to one. I was leaving from the Dole office recently. The place was steaming with people. There were at least 60 people. It really opens your eyes to what's happening. When is the money pit going to end? Well, 60 is only a tip of the iceberg. We know how many people claim social welfare in this county. It is not a secret. But I take your point. Sometimes it can seem quite shocking looking on. Now, Rosina Doherty is a cancer services campaigner and joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Rosina. Thank you so much for your time today. How are you keeping, Rosina? Rosina?
All's good, yes.
Good
all's
stuff.
Good.
Okay, right. So we know you've held a number of protests now outside Letterkenny University Hospital and one also being planned. You managed to secure a meeting with Letterkenny University Hospital management yesterday. So who was at the meeting and what was the subject matter, I suppose, for those not aware?
So at the meeting, there was hospital management. There was a doctor, there was public representatives, and then there was myself and other cancer campaigners for the hospital.
And what were the key issues that you wished to raise?
So the key issue yesterday was about the facilities and what they were actually going to do about the facilities.
Can you remind listeners the issue with the facilities, Rosina? I'm just conscious that not everyone has followed the story from the beginning. So from your perspective, what are the problems?
So the problems are the cancer care, the oncology and haematology day unit is too small for the hospital. It hasn't changed in over 20 years in the population of this county, and the rate of cancer patients has changed. The amount of cancer patients that are surviving cancer has changed. So everything else has changed except the facility that everyone needs to be treated in. So we need a bigger day unit. We need more offices. There's just so much needed that I personally think we need a standalone unit and everything under the one roof to make life easier for the consultants, the doctors, the nurses, and anyone has to work in there. So yesterday's meeting, I was actually very surprised I got the meeting as quick as I did, and I was very grateful for that. So yesterday's meeting, we had, it was five TDs, three councillors, and the first thing that was done was everyone came together and it was agreed that we were standing together for the good of the county, regardless of your political party. Because that is really important, that everyone is in this together for the one reason. And we're in it to get the people of Donegal better facilities. So that was the first on the agenda and everyone was in agreement to that, which was great because it's not a place for people to be disagreeing with people just because of their political background. Then we just pitched it to Sean Murphy. what the county needs and like what is lacking, what is so badly lacking. And in fairness to him, he is so aware of this too. He doesn't actually walk around with his eyes closed. So he was in agreement with us. I learned yesterday that although Sean Murphy is the hospital management, there is a chain of command above him. He doesn't get to write the checks, unfortunately. So we have to go above that and take our campaign higher to those that do hold the purse, basically.
Yeah, and I'm not saying he's part of the campaign, don't get me wrong, but it sounds like, you know, everything that you're looking for, he's also trying to secure and achieve, but he has his higher-ups to convince.
Yes, yes. I've learned so much about politics, about medical politics. It's like there is just so much in it that I wasn't aware of because it wasn't my job to be aware of it, really. So now, yes, I did. Like the meeting was over 2 hours long. By no means did we feel like we were rushed through it. We talked about a lot of things that need to be done. Like there is a lot of people above Sean Murphy that need to be aware of this as well. It seems to be that because the SAILTA has got the 7 hospitals and it is now no longer called SAILTA, there's a lot of people in that who are also pushing for Galway to be the main cancer centre. So we have a lot of people to convince that it's not good enough. And some of these people are taking their orders probably directly from the top dogs in HSE, which is going to make it harder, but we just have to keep pushing on because this is really, really important that we don't have people travelling 240 kilometres for basic chemotherapy that Letterkenny is well able to give if it had the facilities to give it, and it's not fair.
But as you say that, you know, are we battling policy here? Because I do recall the head of the HSC in this area at that time saying, look, the bottom line is if people have to travel for care and if it's the best care, then so be it. You know, and that comment resonates in my head, effectively saying that, you know, if they are of the view that outcomes are better in Galway, whether we agree or disagree, well, then that's what they're going to do. Do you have any concerns about the level of service being retained as it is in Letterkenny University Hospital? Like, are we battling to hold on to what we have as well as battling to see an increase from, you know, your reflections from that meeting?
Yeah, we are battling. It's something so simple, and this, I was really taken back by this yesterday. So when I met with Sean Murphy in 2022, he told me that the asbestos septic unit, I don't even know if I'm saying that word right, but it's a unit that's in the day unit that should be moved, and it would give 3 to 4 more beds. It's not a lot, but 3 to 4 more beds or more chairs for chemotherapy. So he told me, yeah, that's going to be moved. So that was 2022. When I did a bit of research, apparently that chat has been ongoing since 2019. When I said to him yesterday, he said, we do have like a place to put it, but it's going to be at least 2027.
Why?
I was like, why? Because everything has to go through somebody higher than him, somebody higher than that, somebody higher than that.
Just to move things around, not necessarily increase stuff, just to move
planning
things.
Permission. Like, I just was like, you think if he's the hospital manager, it's up to him. It's his job that he should see where this needs to go and do it. But no, it's just not that simple. Which I just, and when I said to him, like, 2027, are you joking? He's like, unfortunately not. That's just how it is. Like this ambulatory care centre that we are talking about. Like apparently the HSE has said that Letterkenny will be getting no funding in 2025. They'll see in 2026. That is to fund this ambulatory care centre. So even if they do give the funding next year, it's going to be at least 2030 before that even. So that's why we need to, a team that were there yesterday that all agreed that we have to do this together. we need to take this higher up and higher up and higher up.
All right, stay there because I will come back to you. I want to bring Boyd Robinson in as well. Boyd's father received cancer care in Letterkenny University Hospital. Sadly, he passed away in November 2023. He was a cancer patient in LUH, in and out of hospital for 15 months with Hodgkin's lymphoma. Boyd, obviously, condolences on the passing of your father, but we're talking about his care. And what's your reflections, Boyd, on his and the family's experiences?
Yeah, the first thing I would say, Greg, is the team in the day services and the oncology unit in Letterkenny are top class. We couldn't ask for better care from a father. They looked after us really, really well. But we as a family, I suppose, the one thing that we found really, really difficult during Dad's illness was the fact that every time Dad had to be admitted to hospital, he had to go through the A&E department. And on several occasions, that wait was over 24 hours. First thing we say to you whenever you have cancer is to isolate yourself because your immune system's so low. And yet, when you go to Letterkenny Hospital, the first thing that happens is that you have to be put in with probably the sickest people in the county and wait for long periods of time to be accessed into the right ward. Another thing that happened during the period as well is a lot of the times there wasn't beds in the oncology unit, so Dad had to spend time in different wards in hospital and surgical and medical wards. And while the staff there were excellent as well, we just didn't have the training to deal with cancer patients. And we found those periods really, really difficult whenever he wasn't in oncology.
Yeah, and of course, too, you know, being exposed to infection can affect him, his health, but also his treatment program as well. It seems nonsensical that someone with a lowered immune system would have to wait 24 hours in a room where, as you quite rightly pointed out there, the sickest people in Donegal happen to be.
Yeah, and it got to the point where my father, you know, when he was really, really ill, wouldn't even go into the hospital. You know, and in fairness to the oncology team, in some occasions they were able to try and fast track us. We would ring them and they would come down to the A&E and try and get them in as quick as they possibly can, but that was okay when they were available, but on numerous occasions that wasn't the case.
I might not have to say this, but it's important to note as well that these were some of the last days and experiences of his life and some of the last memories that Yusuf, a family, have watching on. Now, I'm sure there's amazing memories throughout through his entire life you can focus on, but one honk, you can't help but feel like that this is not the way he should have spent sort of the last months and years of his life.
Yeah, and I suppose like one of the times that I really seen the need for a separate cancer unit in Letterkenny was when Dad had to go away. He went to St. Luke's in Dublin for, I think it was just over a week, to get radiotherapy treatment. So that was tough in itself, even having to drive him down and drive him home. But while I was there, you know, it was a cancer only hospital, and there's the most beautiful gardens around it. And we had moments in those gardens that we'll live with forever, you know, that we were able to wheel Dad around, and you know, we loved getting outside, and unfortunately we just don't have that option in Letterkenny. And it's only now that you realise how important small things like that were. And the conversations that we're having in those gardens were just special.
All right, Boyd. Listen, thanks for helping us understand it. I think for me anyway, and I'm sure for others listening, because cancer is the way it is we actually all can, we all get exactly what you're saying, because many of us have sort of gone through little versions of that with our loved ones. Boyd, thank you for helping us there. So, Rosina, where are we at now? Because, like, Do you have hope now, or are you more frustrated? Once you have, the curtain's been pulled back on the system. You've seen it. You've seen the cluster, you know what that it is, right? So have you hope now that there's a united sort of political movement? Or do you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall? Where are you?
Yeah, I do feel that. I feel hopeful now that we've all sat in a room and talked together, that we all have to move forward together, and there's safety in numbers. So we are now hoping to get a meeting with some of the higher ups. And so it's not going to be just one person going to a meeting. We are all going to be there. And when you have a group of people, hopefully they will start to see that we're not taking this line down anymore. This whole chat of going to Galway, like even an email I got from the private secretary of the Minister for Health, like he says in it, the model of care for hospital cancer treatment is centred on 8 designated cancer services serving a defined population and geographical area, and University Hospital Galway is one of these.
Mm-hmm.
Like even just his attitude in that. Like, and I know that fella's just doing a job.
But it's matter of fact, though, isn't it? It's just saying this is it. Yeah. And yet we're talking about life and death. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of miles. We're talking about hundreds of, we're talking about thousands of euro. We're talking disrupted families. And yet it's just like, this is the way it is. But we have that nothing north of the Galway Dublin line. I think what we have to do is we have to try and secure another interview with A, the minister responsible, but also the head of Sealta, and get these questions put to him back on the record again.
So I do think the next person is the head of Sealta. And then if we have to go then to the, who do we have to go to? The Department of Health. All these people before you get to the minister.
Is your next process still going ahead?
Yeah.
Or maybe so it's even more important now?
The protest is still going ahead on Saturday outside the hospital. And I really, again, I'm stressing it even more now than I was stressing it before, because I didn't realise how far we have to actually get this out. I just think that the next one after this one on Saturday, if I have to take it further, like, I don't know, do we have to take it to Galway and campaign outside Galway Hospital to get better services in Letterkenny? Because I would safely say there are some people in Galway Hospital would be grateful if we had better services in Letterkenny, because they are up to their eyes as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rosina, listen, thanks very much for your time and giving us that really good update on that meeting. Take care of yourself. Go ahead. Did you want to say one more thing?
No.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Rosina. Take care of yourself. Okay, we'll be back with the weather after these.